Whether you know your kimchi from your kefir or it's your first time boiling an egg, you'll be able to make delicious meals easily with The Guardian's new Feast app. Discover vibrant vegan dishes with me, Mira Soda, hearty comfort foods with Nigel Slater, bold flavours with Yotam Ottolenghi, and many more tasty offerings from expert Guardian cooks. Experience the ultimate cooking app, Feast, today. Download now and enjoy a 14-day free trial. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, and welcome back to the World Soccer Talk podcast. My name is Christopher Harris. I'm joined by Kartik Krishnaiyer. Kartik, it's so good to be back. This has been a very long time. We had over the Euros thus far, we had Nick Webster bringing you kind of a daily travelogue of his journeys throughout Germany, going to the games, going to the different cities, going on bicycles and trains. And that was really interesting. I enjoyed that too. But it's good to be back. So, Kartik, what's your initial thoughts? Let's go into the tournament first of all. And we'll catch listeners up in terms of kind of everything that's been going on behind the scenes. But what's your first impressions of Euro 2024 thus far, and then also Copa America?
Well, Copa America, I haven't really been that glued into, so I can't speak to it. But Euro 2024 has been an uneven tournament. It's been a tournament where I think the group stage of the tournament was very good, very even. We saw some of the sides that I expected to surprise in this tournament, namely Austria, Turkey, and Switzerland, do very well. I don't know why anyone thinks Switzerland's a surprise anymore. They actually now have made the knockout stages of six successive tournaments, major tournaments. The only nation in Europe that can match that is France. So consistently, they've been one of the better countries in Europe. They just never get to the semifinals of tournaments, right? So that's why maybe we don't consider them among the best. The knockout stage, with the exception of that Austria-Turkey match, which again were two of the teams I came into the tournament expecting to do quite well, has been kind of dour. And I think the sides we thought might be the better sides in the tournament have been very cagey in how they've played. Coming off a long European campaign, also just the evenness of football in Europe, unlike the other continents around the world. Although we saw some of this in the Asian Cup, right? Asian Championships. There were lots of upsets. It seemed like a more even tournament. But that would be my contrast with Copa America. I haven't watched Copa America that closely, Chris, but I think Copa America, for the most part, has been predictable. And I know people outside of the bubble might say, oh, Uruguay advancing over Brazil is a surprise. No, in fact, the surprise to me was that it went to pens. But of course, Uruguay was playing with 10 men for much of that match. But nothing really surprising in that tournament. Maybe Canada's run somewhat surprising. But other than that, a very two-form tournament. You could say the Euros, maybe based on who's in the semifinals, have gone to form. But to that point, it was competitive matches, not much separating the sides, maybe a lot of good fortune for the favorites before the tournament. None of them have really clicked other than Spain. So I think it's been a good tournament.
Yeah, and for listeners too, we'll get to the discussion about Fox Sports' coverage of this competition, of Euros and Copa America, as well as Univision, TUDN, VIX's coverage too. We'll get to that in a little bit, as well as a ton of other things that you, the listeners, want to talk about. We got a really, really great, as always, listener mailbag with a lot of your questions and thoughts and comments that we'll definitely read through. And there's a lot to catch up on. But in terms of the tournament itself, the Euros, yeah, the kind of the later rounds, the quarterfinals, to me, yes, those aren't the most amazing matches where it's like goals galore and it's, you mean, a 3-2 win for France or anything like that. But what I would say, especially in those knockout rounds, is that I've been really impressed by the defending. And that's part of the reason that some of these games have gone to 0-0 and then gone to extra time, is that the defending has been so good. So we've seen, you know, the Turkey-Netherlands game, you know, it was a really tight game, and some of the defending, you know, players, like defenders, like flying across the penalty box to block a shot. So we've seen that with, you know, countless teams. And that's what's impressed me a lot. So sometimes people saying like, you know, a 0-0 game or a low scoring game, 1-1, just so boring and so predictable. But I think there's a reason for that. We're seeing kind of top level teams. And yes, not every single country or nation at the Euros is playing up to the par that we would expect them to, except for Spain. But to me, watching the tournament itself, you mean, has been entertaining. The match atmospheres have been incredible. Seeing sold out stadiums, the quality of play has been good. And yes, there have been some surprises, but to me, it's been thoroughly entertaining. Every time, you mean, it's the Euros, you mean, playing that day, I'm excited. And the same thing for Copa America too. Going into Copa America, it just fits perfectly in my schedules, where you can watch the games in the evening and later at night, and enjoy those. What I would say, it's having these two competitions played at the same time is so different. And it's not just the sold out stadiums or the match atmospheres at Euro 2024, or the pitch quality and how much better the field conditions are. To me, what it comes down to, it's almost like you have two completely different sports. You've got the Euros, which is, I mean, the referees are more involved in the games. I mean, the fouls they'll call, they'll blow the whistle more often. And then you've got another completely different sport in Copa America, where the referees aren't calling hardly anything. The standard of refereeing is atrocious. And so players know that. They push things to the limit. And what you end up with is a very, at times it can be ugly. At times it can be open and attacking, but it's nonstop sometimes. Or sometimes it's the opposite of that, where there's just foul after foul after foul, where the referees are not calling it. And it's just, it kind of devolves into not even a soccer game, more like a rugby game. But having these two competitions on at the same time, depending on which style you prefer in terms of football on the pitch, but also football off the pitch, are two completely different tournaments. And I'm enjoying both, but boy, Kartik, what a difference.
Yeah, I mean, I have to admit, you know, part of the reason I haven't watched Copa America as I was working the cricket T20 World Cup. So it just, there was only so many hours in the day. But the thing that I learned during that cricket T20 World Cup is that a lot of the fandom in cricket is similar. I would compare it more to South American national teams. I think there's more fandom, and this is a cultural distinction here. Yes, there are people who support and follow European national teams, and you see that in the Euros. They're traveling, they're supporting their national teams, but there tends to be more of an emphasis on the club game in Europe. And in fact, when we talk about nations like England and Spain in particular, or even Italy to a certain extent now, and Germany, who are hosting this tournament, a lot of the national team fans are not fans of the bigger clubs, right? And a lot of the bigger club fans are kind of, I mean, I know several Spanish people this way, and many English people, you and I both know many English people, kind of indifferent to the national team. They might watch it when it's on, but they don't spend their lives thinking about it. What I found with cricket, which I follow cricket passively, but I've never really been thrown into a tournament like this, is that in that sport, you have fan bases that travel the world following their national sides, particularly from the Indian subcontinent, but also from some other places, that reminded me of South American national teams, where there's an emphasis of club over country. I was even having this conversation about Copa America with someone from Latin America after the Cricket World Cup. And I said, hey, you know, I found, and maybe it's also because of the sort of nations that emphasize cricket. They tend to be outside Europe, their former British colonial possessions. So there's a real sense of nationalism right around their national teams in cricket. Same sort of thing as football for Latin America. There's a sense of nationalism around it. It's different, the passion. So even the Canada-Venezuela match in Dallas on whatever day that was, Friday, I mean, the sort of frenzy in the crowd, you don't necessarily have at a Euro match. The Euro match kind of feels like any other international tournament. That all having been said, I share your analysis of the football itself. It's almost like two different sports. I think what we see in every subsequent Euro tournament and some of the World Cups, Chris, is we see these tactical changes. We see the next phase of the sport of football, the next phase of the game taking hold. In this Euro tournament, what we're seeing is a lot of let's test keepers from outside the box. Let's try and quickly wrong foot the defender and take a shot from distance. This might be the way to beat the tactics of today that we see in the club game that have been mastered by the likes of Pep Guardiola. So just from that standpoint, the Euros are much more interesting, right? I mean, Copa America is a bit of a throwback, very physical, very passionate, maybe more passionate. But I think you're right. You're seeing almost two different sports. And I think maybe we'll wait on the Fox angle. But I think Fox plays into that because they're covering both tournaments. So it allows us to kind of appreciate the differences.
So let's move to talking about just a few select teams, Kartik. And with your, I want to get your opinions about how you think these teams are doing or have done in the tournaments that we've mentioned. But if I may, Kartik, don't talk about the fans or the fan base. Let's just talk about the team itself on the pitch and the coach, the head coach, managerial, in terms of what they're getting out of these different teams. And let's start off with, you know, both you and I are Americans. Most of our listeners are Americans. Let's start off in terms of your opinions about the USA crashing out of Copa America.
Well, this is a tough one for me because I think I know you disagree and a lot of people disagree, but I think the U.S. actually overachieved, I think, quite dramatically from a historical perspective, not a historical perspective based on the U.S., but based on the sort of side they had in Greg Berhalter's first cycle. But second cycles are always tough for national team managers, right? I mean, we've seen this over and over again. Deschamps may be the exception, although, yeah, I mean, you could argue he wasn't the exception with the way Euro 2020 went, right? Maybe he should have been sacked after that, or Euro 2021. I think we're calling it Euro 2020, but it was in 2021. U.S., very poor in the run-up to the tournament. I think you have a situation where players have hit a wall in terms of their club careers, with the exception of Christian Pulisic, who is on a different plane than the other American players. But the rest are kind of just, you know, kind of pedestrian players. So maybe you need a manager who's going to get more out of them. I don't think Berhalter has done a terrible job, even in the second cycle. I just don't think the team is particularly good. So they were always going to lose to Uruguay. So it came down to the Panama match and they lost that. So yeah, they underachieved.
Right. Yeah. And that one coaching decision at halftime of the Panama match with it tied at 1-1, down to 10 men looking at the second half. I mean, that was Berhalter's probably biggest and probably last mistake as the U.S. men's national team coach. Last big mistake is, rather than going for the win, he was trying to settle for the draw, and that backfired. And you know, Kartik, better than anyone in terms of Panama is a good team. Not only is Panama a good team, but Panama has a really good record against the United States. I think in the last four games, I think Panama has won three of those. So it's not like Panama is just a minnow that Greg Berhalter didn't really know or, I mean, wouldn't really appreciate. He knew, but that was the big mistake. That was kind of setting off that second half, playing, basically making substitutions to go more defensive, and then just trying to hold on for a draw, which is ridiculous because we all know that in that last game against Uruguay, it was unlikely that the U.S. would get a result in that game. So it had to come down to that Panama game. And really, at the end of the day, to me at least, Berhalter failed us. What I would say, Kartik, is that based on social media and based on the reaction from a lot of USA fans, USMNT fans, either in person or on social media, is there was kind of almost like a shock and horror about this. And just kind of a huge come down, a huge drop in terms of where their expectations were and kind of the reality of the situation. You and I both, although we disagree in terms of the U.S., I think they've underachieved for a long time. It's been 7 long years with Greg Berhalter. They haven't really been tested at the highest level against the big opposition from abroad. Oftentimes, even when given the opportunity, they're playing games against weaker opposition in friendlies just to kind of get comfortable. You have a different viewpoint, and I respect that. But what I would say is that the expectations of this U.S. squad, part of the reason for that golden generation tag that they were given was Fox Sports. Fox, from the last World Cup in 2022, had all these big, whether it's on social media, whether it's on podcasts, whether it's on the television, kind of building this team up into, this is the golden generation, just building up that excitement level to, even huge expectations. And then what we saw was the reality, which I think you and I both agree that, yes, Pulisic is a great player. Yes, Tyler Adams, I think he's one of the better players on the team. Gio Reyna, yeah, I think I see the creativity, but definitely there's issues and injury problems also. But this team did not live up to expectations. My expectations were basically that they would get out of the group and probably get knocked out in the knockout stages. But it seems that most U.S. fans, because of Fox Sports, not just Fox, I think CBS and many others, had built this team into something so huge. I would include The Athletic in that. Built this team into something huge when they weren't that. Yes, we want them to win. Yes, we want to be excited. Yes, we want to look forward to seeing how well they develop. And yes, a lot of these players play at some of the biggest clubs in Europe or are on the books of clubs in Europe. But the reality is, most of these players are not playing week in, week out at really top level clubs. A lot of them are coming on as substitutes. Kartik, do you disagree with that?
No, I completely agree with that, which is, first off, when the U.S. had guys that were playing at clubs fighting relegation or were playing in MLS trying to prove themselves and get the ticket out, or in some cases, even in USL or NASL in those days, I think the team was better. Like, you have a lot of guys that are effectively journeyman guys who are somewhere between 12 and 18 on big club rosters. Again, Pulisic exempted. One really good player. I'm not sure he's an elite player. He might be. We can debate that. But one really good player doesn't make a national team a surefire ticket to get out of the knockout stages of get out of the group stages of a major tournament. By the way, yeah, every single country in the Euros has a player at Pulisic's level or better, with maybe just a few exceptions. And so I think you have a lot of guys that aren't playing regularly, that have injury problems, that have fitness problems, that have not kicked on. We have seen this before with other nations where they have they tout guys when they're 18, 19, 20 years old. And by the time those guys are 23 or 24, they're just journeyman players. Seen it over and over again, actually, in world football, which is why, again, I don't think the U.S. overachieved in the 2022 cycle. I don't think they underachieved. I think they actually overachieved. When you have a core of young players, it's very tough to qualify for a tournament. Then it's very difficult to get out of a group in a tournament. And the U.S. had, 5 points, I think, in the World Cup, which was pretty good. Maybe not a good knockout stage match. That showed their naivety and their youth. But this has been, to your point, The Athletic, CBS Sports and Fox Sports, and other, I think a lot of people with, I would call influencers on YouTube and on other social media platforms have oversold this national team side. And look, they don't want any pushback on that. When I pushed back in the past and said, look, I actually watched the Bundesliga. This guy, he has to beat, let's take the example of Ricardo Pepi. He has to beat out Gregoric. He's got to beat out Vargas. He's got to beat out Andre Hahn at Augsburg. Yeah, he's not an auto. Oh, well, the coach just doesn't like Americans, right? So this is always the pushback. Or, oh, the coach is he doesn't respect this guy's talents. I'm just using Pepi as one example because that came up when I actually watched the Bundesliga, and the people who are promoting these U.S. players don't. and they don't know who else is on the side. They don't respect whoever else is on those club teams. And then the same thing has gone on with Juventus and McKinney and with Weah, wherever he's been, and Adams and Aronson. Aronson, who was awful this past year in the Bundesliga. Yeah. I just don't think these guys are at the level that you'd think they are. And then when you turn on CBS, you get nonsensical analysis. Okay, you get and then that has now translated to Fox with Clint Dempsey. He doesn't say anything valid about these players. Doesn't seem to have any sort of understanding of how these players are doing at the club level. I mean, for all the criticisms of Alexi Lalas out there, I mean, at least Lalas is about to say, yeah, he says, hey, maybe these guys aren't that good. Maybe these guys are missing something. The others don't want to say that. And the Athletic's coverage, Chris, I mean, you've hit on a major nerve with me. I'll just leave it. I'll let that one lie because we could take up 2 hours with me critiquing the Athletic's coverage of both the men's and women's national teams. And they've turned into kind of the equivalent of the jingoistic press we see in England about the English national team or other countries about their national teams. I mean, which is very surprising from a publication that has a lot of good writers who do great work on MLS, do great work on NWSL. But then when it comes to the do good work on USL when they cover USL. When it comes to the national teams, it's something totally different.
What I would say about the U.S., though, is that I believe that a top-level coach could get more out of this team in terms of whether it's man management, tactical, or just basically helping develop these players. And I think, to me, the reality is that basically the way that the U.S. plays under Berhalter, and they tried to do this under Berhalter, but he wanted to make it more of a possession-based team. And to me, the strength in the U.S. has always been a counter-attacking team, very physical, very athletic, more so athletic than a lot of these other teams, with speed, breaking on the counter, and basically trying to beat the big teams. And you look back through the 90s or the 2000s, even the USA team, beat England. They went to, what is it, a semifinal in Copa America and lost against Argentina. They went to the World Cup.
Well, they beat Argentina in 1995 in the Copa America.
Oh, 95. That's right. That's right.
Yeah,
it was a huge
Argentina.
Shock. But then you look also
Argentina 3-0.
And then the 2002 World Cup, I think it was, Kartik, right? They went almost to the, they went to the quarterfinals, right? And then... Yeah. And then we almost made it to the semifinal.
Beat Spain in the 2009 Confederations Cup. And what I would say about that is there were a number of injuries that took place after that tournament before the 2010 World Cup. I think we were teed up to go a long way in the 2010 World Cup. I think we could have been a semifinalist in that tournament if not for the injuries. To your point, Chris, you're spot on this. Now, here is the problem. The U.S., and I think you know this too, because you've been around the game as long as I have in this country. As long as I've been around the sport in this country, about 30 years, the United States has been obsessed with this idea that we have to create our own distinct playing style that's easier on the eyes. Even though we had counterattacking national teams that were very effective, 2002, 2009, 2010, as you talked about, we always felt like we needed to be the team that imposed ourselves eventually. And I've heard that as long as I've been around. Well, we're only going to be a great football or soccer playing nation when we develop our own style, which is a front-footed style. So that is where the Berhalter management philosophy comes in. And I think given the U.S.'s 30-year or more, 30 years for me, it's maybe 40 years overall, obsession with style, I think Berhalter was hired. We know the nepotism and charges, and the federation itself is a malfeasance and misgoverns the game in this country. So, but I think the justification for hiring him was based on that style. I agree with you totally. Why can't the U.S. be like Uruguay? I mean, Bielsa's come in there and realized, okay, the DNA Tavares put in there, I can't really change. They played on the front foot, Bielsa ball, a bit in South American qualifying. But you saw that match against Argentina where they beat them in qualifying a couple months ago.
Yeah.
They reverted to the way they typically play. And they're doing a lot of that in this tournament. So why can't the U.S. be like that? I think if you sack Berhalter, You have to grapple with that question. Are you going to continue the project of trying to create this style that makes you play like the Dutch or the, and by the way, the Dutch don't play that way anymore, but play like the Dutch or the Spanish or whoever. There's always been kind of an obsession with the Dutch in particular in the U.S. So that's why I don't think a coincidence Berhalter was hired in spite of all the other charges of nepotism, et cetera. Or do you just say, okay, we're hosting a World Cup in 2 years. It's not about style. It's not about imposing our will. It's about results. Look at Deschamps in France. They have never played well in a tournament, in my opinion. They've just kind of gotten through tournaments, and yet they've gotten to the finals of, you know, 3 of the last 4 major tournaments. It could be 4 of the last 5 by the time people listen to this. So maybe you just pull it back now. But I don't know if U.S. soccer feels like they can do that. So I think you hit on something really fundamental, which is the style.
Yeah, well, one last thing before we move on to the next nation we're going to talk about. But that's, I mean, with the U.S., with Greg Berhalter, he's been in charge for 7 years, 2 cycles. And in those 7 years, he never once got a win against a top 25 FIFA Coca-Cola ranked team outside of CONCACAF. So just think about that for a second. Top 25, the U.S. had never beaten any of those teams in the top 25 rankings in 7 years. Except for CONCACAF teams. And part of that reason is that because the U.S. wasn't playing those teams in friendlies, they were choosing to play, I don't know, Oman or New Zealand or Wales or other teams that they knew that they would beat, teams that probably wouldn't test them that much, but would give them some experience, probably wouldn't sell out stadiums, but would just be easy approach. Let's get some results, let's get some wins. Which is why Greg Berhalter's win percentage looks so good on paper, is because for the most part, they played really weaker teams. Kartik, let's move on. What about England? What's your thoughts on England in terms of what you've seen thus far in the Euros?
Okay, I'm not trying to be a contrarian here. I'm not trying to be the A word, for lack of a better term. But I don't understand the reaction in Britain. I know you didn't want to talk about the fans and the media, but I mean, England was in a tough group. I thought Serbia might beat them. I overrated Serbia before the tournament, admittedly. They got a win there. I didn't see that match because I was at cricket while that was going on. Denmark, a match that, you know, they were fortunate to beat Denmark in the semifinals of the Euros last go around at home in front of a crowd that didn't exist other than England fans. So that's, you know, an okay result. Slovenia, that was bad. I could see that, but Slovenia played a very negative game. Slovakia is a team I rate highly. I told a member of the English press before that match, hey, Slovakia has always played England tough. I wouldn't be surprised if they beat them. And they almost did. They were about a minute away from beating them. And then Switzerland, to me, is one of the 3 or 4 best teams in Europe at this point. So they didn't beat Switzerland, right? They were very fortunate to get the penalties, right? All the opportunities in extra time fell to Switzerland. Let's talk about Shaqiri for a minute. Sorry for the diversion, but man, I mean, that Olympico, he almost pulled that off. So I think England's done okay. I mean, I think they're limited. I certainly think they'll beat the Netherlands because the Dutch, this is one of the weakest Dutch teams I've seen, and they don't have Koopmans, they don't have De Jong. So their midfield has been Simons is playing in midfield, which is all Koeman can do. But I don't think they've been that bad defensively. They've been strong. I think the three at the back didn't work against Switzerland. So Gehi comes back. I think they'll go back. They'll revert to the previous formation. I do think the big issue, I do think there has been one significant issue with England, which is if you look at the way Declan Rice plays for Arsenal, Rice plays generally with someone like a Jorginho or Partey playing behind him, doing that work, right? And I think England doesn't have that player, right? Calvin Phillips is bombed out. Manu maybe not ready, although he's looked okay, right, when he's played. But I think that's the issue. England not having that 6, which is why in defense of Gareth Southgate, privately, I've defended him a lot to people during this tournament. I understand why he put Trent Alexander-Arnold in that team the first 2 matches. It didn't work, but I think Southgate saw exactly what I saw, which is, okay, when did Arsenal really get going in this past season? It was when Mikel Arteta came to the same realization about Declan Rice that we, whether we just talked about. Declan Rice is more of an eight than a six. And he had Socek playing behind him, remember, at West Ham. So basically, you need that player. So that's why when Arsenal goes on that run at the end of the season and almost wins the title, you saw Partey back in the team. You saw Jorginho in the team a lot, right? TAA can't do that job. You know, I've thought that maybe you put John Stones in that role. That's where maybe I would fault Southgate. Maybe you put Stones there and you can play Gehi and Konsa at center backs, although maybe that's a bit risky. I think the decision not to bring Harry Maguire to the tournament, they've gotten away with so far. Also, he would have taken a penalty, I assume, against Switzerland. But they made all their penalties anyway. But I think maybe that they're going to come back. That'll come back to haunt them. Not taking Harry Maguire. I think not taking Jadon Sancho the way he finished the year for Dortmund may have been a mistake. And then maybe Loftus-Cheek. Loftus-Cheek had some moments at Milan this past season where maybe he could play in that role, or he and Rice could play off of each other. So ultimately, if England doesn't win the Euros, Chris, it may come down to those three omissions that I talked about. I mean, did you have to take Adam Wharton to the tournament? I mean, what's the point of that? Conor Gallagher is not up to the level, clearly. So yeah. That may be. So taking Gallagher over Loftus-Cheek would be one I would point to if England doesn't win this tournament.
Yeah, and Conor Gallagher, I'm not a big fan of. He's very aggressive, sometimes a little bit too much, a little bit over the top, where he could concede a penalty on the edge, even kind of the edge of the penalty area, or concede a free kick in dangerous places. But he is a workhorse. He will, I mean, run. He will even press. He'll go 100 miles an hour. But with that, you do get a little bit of risk there. I think with England, I think the disappointment really, and this is coming from a lot of fans in England, is just that we know that they can play better. They're getting the wins, scraping by. Gareth Southgate still very cautious, but too cautious, and sometimes just now and again, you let them go, let them run. And Cole Palmer is probably the perfect example of that. I think is that when he has come on, in almost every game he's come on as a sub, he's made a difference, and immediately you can see kind of like how he's able to really, whether it's from his dribbling or his passing, or I mean just his vision to open up defenses, and suddenly then all of a sudden you're unlocking the opponent's defense. And against Switzerland, it was one of those things that as soon as Switzerland scored that goal, Southgate made the changes then, and it's very reactive. So as soon as Switzerland scores that goal, then England starts playing better. All of a sudden it comes out of its shell. It knows it has to go forward. It knows the team knows it has to get that goal to equalize, to try to stay in. My concern is that if you play against the Netherlands and then it's 89th minute and Netherlands score, is then you don't have the time then to bounce back. But one more thing I'd say about England, Kartik, is that I think USA fans would be happy with Gareth Southgate playing boring football, but playing football that wins games, that outcoaches the other coach, that's tactically very, very astute, and sees a team progress through the tournament. I don't think the US necessarily needs or wants kind of a coach that's going to play an attacking brand of football on the front foot, possession based, which is what Berhalter has wanted since day one. In terms of identity, it's all about winning games to me rather than the identity. If England goes on to win the Euros, no one's going to care about identity. They just care about winning games. And to me, maybe Gareth Southgate, maybe he would be a good candidate for the US job if he decides to step down after the Euros, whether they win or lose. But that's someone that I think they can get more out of a team, especially tactically. And then Kartik, Brazil. I mean, I know you said you haven't watched much of Copa America, but what a disaster! One of our writers, Diallo Akinbade, on our website worldsoccertalk.com, wrote an article about is this the worst Brazil team we've seen in decades? I mean, absolutely awful in terms of style of football, play acting, lack of skill. I mean, this is to me, this is the worst Brazil team I can ever remember.
Yeah, but I actually, again, my expectations are based on what I've seen in qualifying and right. in the last few years. And I mean, they've been bad in South American qualifying. They are fortunate this is a 48-team World Cup. Brazil might not qualify or might be sent to an intercontinental playoff where, you know, they could lose, right? We saw Costa Rica draw them in Copa. We saw Costa Rica beat. Did Costa Rica beat Peru? No, Australia beat Peru, right? But still, you know, Australia, high-level team from Asia, Asian Confederation. Brazil might not make the World Cup if this wasn't a 48-team World Cup. Their midfield has been hollowed out. I think you're talking about a lot of guys that are role players at their clubs, similar to the U.S., role players at their clubs. Paquetá is not really the classic Brazilian number 10. You've got, outside of Vinny Jr., who hasn't been great for Brazil, even though he's an elite, world-class player, not even elite, world-class player at the club level. But maybe that doesn't speak to Vinny Jr. That speaks to the surrounding cast. I mean, it's the same thing as Neymar. I think Neymar was always sort of a letdown for Brazil, even though he was a great player at the European club level. It probably had to do with the players around him. There is a generational gap that now has been going on for a long time with Brazil. And Brazil has performed poorly in World Cups since they won in 2002. 2006, the French beat them. 2010, the Dutch beat them in the quarterfinals. Remember, 14, we all remember what happened.
Germany,
and by the way,
7-1.
Yeah, 7-1. Not only that, they should never have gotten to that stage. They were fortunate to beat Chile in the round of 16. They were fortunate to beat Colombia, very cynically beat Colombia, and Peckerman's a really good Colombian team in 14 in the quarters. 22, obviously, Croatia got the best of them. So 18, they must have lost two to somebody. Belgium, right, of course. Roberto Martinez in Belgium.
Yep.
So I think that this has been coming for a while, honestly. And when I look at South America, I look at a really good, exciting generation of young Ecuadorian players who are maybe not, you know, much like the U.S., maybe they haven't hit on what expectations were, but they're getting there. I look at Colombia in a special moment, maybe the best moment they've been in 30-plus years.
Yep.
I look at Uruguay just kicking on, and I look at Argentina. I mean, Brazil is behind all of them. I mean, Brazil, we're now talking about Brazil in the same bracket. We're talking about Paraguay and Venezuela. I mean, imagine that. So, disappointing tournament, but not a shock at all.
And last but not least, Canada. I would say they're overachieving, Kartik, but still under Jesse Marsh, you mean getting the results that they need. I mean, they have some quality in this side with Jonathan David, Alfonso Davies, Jacob Schlaffenberg. I mean, they've got some really good players on this team. And yes, by the time we're recording, by the time you listen to this podcast, we'll probably already know the Argentina-Canada result. But Canada's got nothing to be ashamed of. I think they've done exceedingly well. And Jesse Marsh, I mean, this was a really smart move by him to go to Canada to manage the national team at the time he did. What's your thoughts? I mean, is there any possibility of a USA appointment, or do you think that the US will look within MLS? Or what's your thoughts on, in terms of, given the track record of the US Soccer Federation when hiring coaches, which oftentimes is a long process, what's your take on where they go next, and also Canada's great run?
So first off, on Canada, I'm a really tough break to lose Buchanan, who obviously won Serie A this year after he transferred in to Inter, lose him in a freaky training ground injury before that quarterfinal against Venezuela. But what an elite player. And to those who criticize Major League Soccer, to those who say the U.S. team should be entirely of European-based players, which seems to be the sentiment on some of the YouTube channels and on social media, look at Canada, 13 MLS guys, a USL guy, several other guys that, if they're in MLS now, came through USL, or if they're in Europe now, came through MLS. They bring in Marsh, who is a bit of a stylist himself. And by the way, what, you know, the unfortunate, they lost to Turkey, But I mean, what a job Ralf Rangnick did with Austria. Yep. I mean, they made them one of the joys to watch in international football. Marsh could do the same with Canada if given time. Whether he wants the time or not, or whether he jumps back into the European club game after this, I don't know. There is an opportunity for him to stay with Canada. Expectations are fairly low. He's been able to punch above those expectations rather quickly. And style aside, even now without Buchanan, which makes things much more difficult. Buchanan, really? Okay, so Buchanan is a guy. When I pushed back at the talk about the U.S. and how great the U.S. is and how many great players the U.S. has had for years, ironically enough, Buchanan is one of the guys I've cited that has developed in Major League Soccer, kind of under the radar, and is Canadian. That I think is better than most American players, and I stand by that. And he had a really good tournament before this really kind of freak injury. Where does the U.S. go? Because I don't think Marsh is going to take the U.S. job. Just knowing some of his people and knowing him, I think at this point he won't take it because of the poison chalice. He would have taken it in 2022 after he was out at Leeds. Yes.
Right.
I was trying to think his timeline. But when he went to Leipzig, I should mention this. When he went to Leipzig to be an assistant to Rangnick in 2018, he knew he wasn't getting the U.S. job. The door had been shut on him for various reasons that we can get into another time. So he doesn't have a great relationship with the Federation, so I don't think it'll be him. Where does the U.S. go? You look at MLS, you look at Jim Curtin, but then is that another style? Is that another, we're going to play on the front foot. Do you need to go get one of these international specialist managers that organizes a team and plays counterattacking football? Or do you find someone in MLS who is going to be more defensive and more organized and relate to the players in a certain way? Now, here's the thing. If you're going to continue to have a very European-based squad, this is why Berhalter was in some ways a smart hire, because Berhalter played very – I don't know, did Berhalter even play in MLS? I think maybe he did at the end of his career. But Berhalter was always a European-based player. In those days when we didn't see as many games from Europe and we were following the national team, Berhalter was one of those curiosities because he was always playing in Holland or Germany or England or wherever, and we didn't see the game. So we were seeing all the guys playing MLS. And actually, that's why I think Berhalter didn't make the 98 World Cup team, because he was playing in the Netherlands. And we probably should have taken him instead of, dare I say it, we probably should have taken him instead of Alexi Lawless. try that one on for size. Right. Because we had Berhalter in the camps right before the World Cup. I mean, I remember he played against Kuwait in the friendly right before the send-off. Do you go and get an MLS manager, and does that maybe change the composition of the squad a little bit? You're looking more at MLS guys. Maybe you're looking. I mean, there are actually. Part of the reason Copa, I haven't been able to watch it as closely. I mentioned the cricket earlier, but it's also because I'm very focused on USL. I now have a job that forces me to focus on USL. So those games are overlapping, right? They're happening at the same time as Copa. They're not happening at the same time as the Euros. Mm-hmm. But there are even some guys in USL you might want to give a look or two to. So I don't know. Or do you go with an international specialist? Do you take a punt on someone like Sam Allardyce or David Moyes, who you think will organize the team? That's really the big question for U.S. soccer. If they're going to go within MLS, I like Curtin, but again, Curtin might be the same style. Curtin has Dutch influences on him, even though he always played in MLS, right? He's getting very kind of Dutch Spanish style in the way Philly Union has set up at times. I don't know who that guy in MLS would be. Maybe it's Cherundolo. But then you get into the same sort of cycle. I mean, Cherundolo is a guy that, even though he's coached in MLS, he never played in MLS, right? He played his entire career in Germany. So I don't know, honestly.
Yeah. My two cents on this is that we're now going to be less than 2 years away from World Cup 2026. This is going to be the best chance in our lifetime that the U.S. is going to play and compete on home soil in a major tournament. Expectations are definitely out of the group stage into the knockout rounds. And beyond that, I'd say quarterfinal would be a minimum based on the kind of home nation, being one of the host nations. And I think you have to go for an international specialist, put this person under a 2-year contract, and then basically put your faith in this manager. We saw that with Jurgen Klinsmann in his first cycle, how well he did in the 2014 World Cup and kind of the heights that the US hit, all the players he brought into camp, the strategy, the connections that he used to bring some players in from overseas, kind of dual nationals, et cetera, or nationals that brought over. But that's my thing, I think you have to go with the actual experience rather than going to an MLS coach. Maybe 2 years from now after the World Cup, yeah, but not for now.
So I have to push back on that point about Klinsmann's connections, because a dear friend of both of ours, Thomas Rongen, if he's listening to this podcast, would want us to, which is a lot of those guys he had identified for Bob Bradley. Bradley had given Jermaine Jones his first cap. Bradley had reached out to Fabian Johnson. Bradley had reached out to John Brooks. In fact, it was Rongen who the story of how Rongen found John Brooks comes through South Florida, comes through Broward County, where I live. So I just have to point that out. But you're right. Yeah. Like that first cycle for Klinsmann, we win qualifying, right? Or CONCACAF qualifying. I mean, if you win it, right? But top of the table, CONCACAF qualifying. And there was a feel-good factor, I think, around the U.S. going into the 2014 World Cup. I don't know if this is ESPN broadcasting versus Fox, but a feel-good factor that you never felt about this particular set of U.S. players. I don't know if that's – I think that there was also guys from MLS that Bradley had ignored that Klinsmann brought in that created that those connections and those synergies. Guys like Kyle Beckerman, guys like Brad Davis. I know the Klinsmann tenure is always judged by Jayasi Zardes and his obsession with Zardes and his pace. Well, guess what? Arena kept picking Zardes, and Berhalter, until a certain point, kept picking Zardes. So Klinsmann was vindicated on that. Last point on what you just said, Chris. I just came off of this Cricket World Cup where the U.S., completely unfancied, kind of laughed off that the U.S. was in the tournament because they were hosting, similar to the way we viewed Qatar in 2022 in World Cup or South Africa in 2010. The U.S. got to the final eight. Now, in that last match, got embarrassed by England. If you understand cricket, England beat the U.S. 20-over total in 9.4 over. So it just humiliated the U.S. in the eights, and England moved on to the semifinals. But the U.S. in cricket, a sport that's not – that most people don't know, even know what it is, because they were hosting a World Cup, got to the final eight. So to say that's the minimum expectation, I think, is spot on, Chris. Russia got to the final eight in 2018. Let's see. Germany, well, obviously, they're in the league. South Korea got to the semifinals when they hosted, 2002. Mm-hmm. Mexico got to the quarterfinals, both in 70 and 86 when they hosted. I think quarterfinals is the minimum expectation. I think you nailed it on that. Even though I'm saying the U.S. has overachieved in the past, that was when the U.S. wasn't hosting tournaments, right? That's based on the U.S. going to Qatar, having to play in qualifying in COVID conditions with a young team, with you know, closed-door stadiums in a lot of cases. 2026 is a whole different ballgame. I think your quarterfinal, what you just said about quarterfinals, that's absolutely right. So that is the minimum expectation for both the U.S. and Mexico. For Canada, it's not. Which is another reason why, back to your previous question, I think Jesse Marsh, given he's been through some, you know, harrowing circumstances at Leeds, and then when he almost had the Leicester job, the minimum expectation at Leicester with them in the dump was that he was going to keep them up, and ultimately didn't take that job. So I think the Canada job is a more realistic; it comes with more realistic expectations for him. Which is another reason I don't think the U.S. job is in the offing for him. But yeah, quarterfinals at a.
Whether you know your kimchi from your kefir or it's your first time boiling an egg, you'll be able to make delicious meals easily with The Guardian's new Feast app. Discover vibrant vegan dishes with Mira Soda, hearty comfort foods with Nigel Slater, bold flavours with Yotam Ottolenghi, and many more tasty offerings from expert Guardian cooks. Experience the ultimate cooking app, Feast, today. Download now and enjoy a 14-day free trial. Terms and conditions apply.
All right, let's move on to talking about the TV broadcasts. And the first thing I'll say, Kartik, is that at the end of May, I went on vacation. I took my family. We went to Europe for a few weeks. So I went to see some relatives, my relatives in Wales and England, my wife's relatives in two parts of Italy, and then our cousins in the Netherlands. So we did a European tour. So we were away for a few weeks. It was a nice break. After just a crazy past 2 years working 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, I just needed a break. And it just so happened to be at the same time as the Euros. I didn't plan it that way. So for the first 2 weeks of coverage of the Euros, I watched it mostly on the BBC or ITV, but mostly on the BBC. And oh my God, what incredible coverage. Incredible. Like, so just a few things. I don't want to go on too much about it, but the studio set, one of the most amazing studio sets I've ever seen. They had a studio that was a glass studio with a glass floor, so you could look down below, overlooking the Brandenburg Gates in Berlin. So just visual-wise, amazing. They're right there, right by the Brandenburg Gate. You can look down and see the city traffic moving back and forth. And then the analysts, so everyone from Gary Lineker, Alan Shearer, Micah Richards, etc. But the standout person I saw in that coverage was Cesc Fabregas. And wow, what an analyst in terms of the way he's able to like pinpoint exactly what's happening in games and to elevate the discussion where like you walk away after listening to him going like, wow, I didn't think about that. That's really, really intelligent, fantastic analysis that makes you think differently about the game. It educates you, but you're not being talked down to. But really, really good insight there. And hopefully we'll see him again in the future for some broadcasts. Hey, who knows, World Cup coverage in the future. But like, wow, like really, really good. And then I came back to the US. and then I was like knee deep in, okay, all right, Fox Sports for VIX for Copa America and for the Euros. And honestly, you mean, I tweeted about this, but for the Euros, anytime that Alexi Lalas came on television, I changed the channel. I changed the channel to Tudo NA or basically fired up to watch it on VIX. Reason being, nothing political. Reason being is, honestly, I'm just so sick and tired of just the mediocrity. It just in terms of the hot takes and how tired it is just like seeing him on screen. And he actually toned it down a bit from then on. I started watching a little bit here and there. But really, I don't know. I'm just tired and done with Alexi Lalas. I don't think he adds anything to the conversation. It's very predictable. Not a big fan. But anyway, coming back to the US, actually, I think personally, well, let me get your take on this, Kartik, in terms of Fox's coverage of the Euros and Copa America, what you've seen. What's your first impressions? What's your analysis of what you've seen thus far?
Well, since you mentioned nothing political, we should also say that your praise of Gary Lineker is nothing political, because you know, anytime I talk to British people about Lineker, inevitably politics comes up. So you're praising Lineker based on his, you know, his pedigree, right, in terms of, yeah, being not just an analyst, but a presenter as well.
Yeah,
I've seen him do plenty of presenting through the years. I mean, I recently rewatched Lineker. It was Ian Wright, Lineker. Oh gosh, who else was in that studio at the time? It would have been Alan Hansen in 2007 when England lost to Croatia at Wembley and failed to qualify for the 2008 Euros. Really, that match stands in my mind because it was the first time I saw Rakitic or Modric play. And I realized these two guys are going to be, I mean, geez, you know, Modric may be all-time top 15 player, all-time in the history, yep, of the sport. But Lineker, and just the way the presentation is done, on British television. I just got done watching the UK election and was just commenting with my friends in a chat group that how different the presentation of elections are in the UK and in France, as opposed to what you see on US television. So I've come to the realization that as much as we complain about Fox's coverage of soccer, it is very much a reflection of American culture and where it's gone, because that's why CBS has gone in the same direction with their coverage of U.S. related things when they don't go in that way when it comes to Serie A or the Champions League. What does Lawless offer on the Euro broadcast? I guess an American voice. That's it. But who would be better as an American voice on Fox than him? Well, you could argue Stu Holden, but he's calling Copa America matches with John Strong. Otherwise, nobody. I mean, I don't want Clint Dempsey in there. I don't want Maurice Adu in there. I don't want Rob Stone in there. So, yeah, I mean, I think this is where we are. In terms of just overall Fox's coverage, I have to say they've done well with the commentary teams. I think the Ian Dark, Landon Donovan team has been very good. They have a good chemistry, too. Darren Fletcher and Owen Hargreaves, who I think are done now because they kind of signed off and said thank you at the end of the Netherlands Turkey A match, so they don't have a semifinal or final. They were very good, and obviously Derek Ray always excels. So I think they've gotten it right from a commentary team standpoint, Fox, the Euros. Now, in terms of Copa America, real quickly, I just want to say Kobe Jones has been a standout for me as a co-commentator on their broadcasts, maybe saying more than Stu Holden does. I've never been, you know, I've been kind of indifferent towards him, but he's having a, from what I've seen, like I said earlier, I've watched less of that tournament, but from what I've heard, what I've seen, he's stepped up a bit.
Yeah, definitely. I agree with a lot of your analysis there, Kartik. What I would say from my own analysis is that I believe that Fox has gotten much better. I think that I've seen a lot of improvement, which is other than an article about Alexi Lalas and why we think he's terrible. There hasn't been a lot of things to write about or talk about because it has been, it's not like they've been making massive mistakes. It's actually been pretty good. It's been pretty good. And that's a huge accomplishment based on what it's been in the past. So it's definitely been an upgrade. The Alexi Lalas thing still is, yes, now I'm watching him a little bit more, but I still kind of have that urge to kind of grab the remote and switch the channel just because I'm done with him. But the rest of the crew, though, Daniel Sturridge is actually surprisingly good. Very animated. As the tournament's gone on and on, I've got appreciate his comments and value those. Jules Breach, we know from the Premier League, from CBS Sports, and from other places, she's always good. Carly Lloyd is absolutely terrible as an analyst, just really, really poor analysis, even worse than Lalas. And there's so many other female analysts out there that could do a much better job, but I guess they're going for the name with Carly Lloyd. But I respect her as a player, but just don't think of her highly at all.
As an analyst. I mean, I just compare her to Ali Krieger, who's sitting in the ESPN FC studios. I mean, it's night and day. Now, granted, Fox doesn't have the rights to NWSL. NWSL split between four networks, and they're not one of them. So maybe that hurts them getting available talent. Or is Carly Lloyd just part of the Fox shtick? I don't know. I'm sorry to jump in on this, Chris, but this has been a sore point for me during the tournament.
Yeah.
Respect her as a player, but I just nowhere near the top. We have some great female co-commentators and analysts. Lori Lindsay's another one. You could go on and on. I don't know how she ended up being the person in the studio that they're in large portions building their coverage around.
Yeah, the only thing I can guess at with Carly Lloyd is that she's still under contract from doing the last World Cup, and she's under contract, so let's bring her out again. And I guess there definitely was a lot of negative analysis or criticism from the last time that she did a major tournament for Fox. And it's, you mean, it's just really, 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 really poor in terms of her analysis. So when it's Alexei and Carly on at the same time, it's like, oh gosh, here we go. And then Clint Dempsey, yeah, what happened to Clint Dempsey? So Clint, I mean, I respect him as a player, of course, but as an analyst on CBS Sports, he had gotten so much better and was able to really share his honest opinion. And he was critical at times. He was saying like, hey, here's the problems I'm seeing with this U.S. team, or here's where they need to improve, or I think they should be playing more tougher teams in away matches, not so much weak teams in home matches, so on and so forth. Some good analysis. And he grew as an analyst at CBS Sports. But now back over at Fox, I've counted the number of times that he said, you mean something major happens and it's right post-match. Okay, let's go right into the studio, get their takes. And Clint says, you mean, I have no words for what just happened. Well, if you have no words for what just happened, why are you on television as an analyst who, you mean, Fox is paying to have his analysis and have words to put this into context? And that happened after the USA crashed out of the Copa America, too. It's just like Clint's like, I have no words. I can't explain what happened. Well, you should explain. So I think I don't know if he's not paying attention or if it's just the chemistry is not as good or what, but he's definitely taken a couple of steps back in terms of my estimations of him as an analyst. Maybe when he gets back on CBS Sports, maybe he can pick it back up again and get that better analysis. But overall, the studio, even though the studio is not in Europe and it's not in the Copa America host cities, it's in a green screen. It looks like a spaceship. But I think it works because, I mean, they have coverage of both tournaments and it's just easier to have everything come from the same studio. But I think it looks good. It's, I mean, there's been no issues other than just the Alexi Lalas and really disappointment in Carly Lloyd. But overall, I've been pretty impressed, which is definitely a huge compliment for Fox Sports. Based on kind of my track record of being really, really critical about them in terms of how poor they've been in the past.
Yeah, I think their commentary teams for the Euros, as I said, maybe better. I have to think back at the commentary teams that ESPN has had. Obviously, we don't get Stu Robson because it's not on ESPN. That may be the big difference. But I do think that their commentary teams have stood out for me. And actually, even the Jackie Oatley, Warren Barton team that we had criticized during the World Cup, they've gotten a lot better. And I had to blame Barton for that because I listened to Jackie Oatley regularly on broadcast from England, right? Both WSL and Premier League. Actually, she's done some NWSL matches for CBS, CBS over the air here, and she's always quite good. So that's why I assumed it was because of Barton. But Barton raised his game.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I can't complain that much about Fox. I do, but here is where I do complain. So between VIX and Fox, you don't have the sort of, just because of my schedule, there have been times during the Euros I've been out and about. I mentioned, obviously, the overlap with the cricket, although the thing that I found out about cricket is that everybody wants to follow England in the cricket, England football in the cricket world. There are these natural overlaps. So if England's playing like they did against Serbia, then, you know, it gets thrown on a television in the media area. But other matches that people weren't interested in. But so because my schedule, both with the cricket and then other stuff now, the streaming side is a problem, right? So you knew during previous Euros where you could find matches. And it was the ease of access. There is still, I know where to find the matches on streaming now, but there's an ease of access issue. And I think maybe this gets solved with, we haven't heard much more about the coming launch of the super app, if you want to call it that, mm-hmm. with Disney News Corp and Warner Discovery. But maybe that solves it. But VIX has always been kind of clunky for me. So that's a problem. And then Fox's streaming situation, we know, is not ideal. So that's one drawback. In terms of the actual coverage, yeah, this is the first time a tournament's been on Fox where I've said, okay, you know, it's fine. It's on Fox. It's not that different than it being on CBS or ESPN.
Yeah, and I just hope for the next major tournament that maybe they look at Alexi Lalas and say, you know what, I mean, maybe there is a better U.S. analyst out there that could take that spot. Who that person is, it's difficult because oftentimes a lot of the analysts have their blinders on, so they're not as kind of really realistic about the U.S.'s performances or the level of the team. That they seem to be just so focused on the hype. I mean, Lalas will call it as he sees it, but the issue I have with Lalas is, well, there's two, well, there's many issues, but one issue is that it's deliberate. So he's playing a role. He's playing a, you mean, kind of the villain, and he loves that, but it's fake. So a lot of the things he does, he may not, a lot of the things he says, he may not even believe. So me as a viewer watching the broadcasts and listening to him, I'm like, okay, does he really think that? Or is he just taking that contrarian viewpoint or that argument because he wants to be opinionated and wants to have a debate on TV? And then the second thing is that when I hear him speak or see a tweet from him, oftentimes in the back of my head, it almost sounds like it's Don Garber telling Alexi Lalas what to say. And I just feel at times it feels like he's a puppet, where the things he's saying are things that are talking points from a Don Garber presentation or things that he's heard from Don Garber or U.S. Soccer Federation. It just seems to be, so I don't value his analysis, and I question it whenever he opens his mouth, basically.
Yeah, so I think the issue here, Chris, is simply put, contract and compensation. They are paying Alexi. I don't want to divulge too much on the podcast, obviously, but they're paying Alexi Lalas substantially more than they're paying their other talent, other than Rob Stone, who does other sports. I mean, soccer-specific talent. So I think as a result, to get the most out of that, they need to plug them in everywhere.
Okay, so let's continue. Let's get to the listener mailbag. First up is David Catan. David says, I am writing in praise of VIX. For $5 per month, they offer the Euros and Copa America. On top of that, you learn some Spanish. It's frustrating. There's no English streaming option as simple as VIX, even at a higher price point. Thank you, VIX. John Ring wants to talk to us about MLS Season Pass. He says the past couple of episodes discussing MLS Season Pass through Apple has really hit home for me on how MLS continues to just miss huge on this deal with Apple. Let me elaborate. As a Season Pass holder, I get MLS Season Pass for free, but setting it up on my TV at home has been frustrating to the point that I've watched less than 5 minutes the entire season. First, my wife has Apple TV under her ID, so I went to her account to set up my free subscription. However, Apple doesn't let that happen or even be an option. We have to sign out of her account, then set up an Apple account under my email. After doing that, I then have to go into the Apple app on the TV and enter my information. So now we have two accounts on the same TV and need to sign out of each other's account whenever we want to watch an MLS game or when she wants to watch a TV show. Second, now that I'm on the MLS app under my ID, when I go to a match, go to watch a match, Apple has the score listed in the match tile on the screen. If I sign in before the match begins, no problem. However, take tonight, for example, FC Cincinnati against Dallas started at 8:30 Eastern time. So I began my evening watching a 7:30 match, which is Columbus Crew against New England. When I went to the scores, when I went to switch to the 8:30 match, going to the home screen with the tiles of the matches, the scores were all listed. So what incentive do I have to watch a match when the score is already listed in the tile? In my opinion, why watch? I'll just skip it and watch the highlights later. Apple needs to get rid of the score within the tiles. Third, yes, I got MLS Pass for free, so MLS gets to juice their numbers, but the monthly cost of the pass is still not worth it. as it gets you, all it gets you is MLS soccer. No other leagues, no other sport, nothing. Apple and MLS need to do better. So, John, yes, I mean, there is a way to switch off the scores. So you don't see those. It's in the settings. And you head on over to worldsoccertalk.com and you can search for that. We have a couple of articles that take you step by step how to do that. But it shouldn't be that difficult, right? Even across all of Apple, it's the default should be that it's not showing the scores. If you want to see the scores, then switch those on. I mean, that should be the default, is no scores. And the other thing too, Kartik, about all of this too, is so we've gotten a lot of feedback from people about MLS Season Pass. Not all of it we're going to read here, but it's actually been, for me, a little bit refreshing because we've covered MLS in so much detail on the podcast and in articles. It's been a welcome break for me to actually step away from watching MLS for over a month and just watching the Euros, going on vacation, watching Copa America, and just taking a break from Major League Soccer. Not to say that it's a bad league at all, but there's only so much soccer you can watch. And sometimes it's so frustrating watching it for many different reasons. Some of it's political, some of it in terms of just the way that the leagues are set up and the season's set up and all these weird different things, that it's actually been a nice break for me to take a break from it. What about you, Kartik? Have you been watching MLS Season Pass? Have you had time with everything going on to watch much?
No. And I just, unfortunately, I can't really commit to watching MLS at this point. I do have to keep an eye on MLS Next Pro, but even that's becoming kind of a futile thing because what's happening is the level of MLS Next Pro is so far below that of the USL Championship, and I have to keep an eye on USL and keep an eye on players that could be in USL that I haven't really been able to stay in tune with MLS. I do anticipate, though, with Leagues Cup coming up, the tournament's ending, Leagues Cup, to me, still a fantastic tournament conceptually. I don't like that it's become an excuse to dismember US Open Cup. I do anticipate I'll be watching quite a bit of that, and we have U.S. Open Cup quarterfinal round this week on Apple, actually. So first soccer competition outside of MLS, and you know, we know what's happened with the Club World Cup situation with Apple that they'll be showing.
So next up is Jose. Jose says, with the U.S. Open Cup being streamed now on MLS Season Pass as one of the options on Apple TV, will this broadcast deal convince MLS to allow full participation of the 27 U.S.-based clubs next year? Would this be the key to encourage fans to buy MLS Season Pass? And are you guys surprised that the CBS Sports didn't pick up the broadcast rights to the U.S. Open Cup for 2024? I thought they did a very tremendous job last year by airing the final between Inter Miami and Houston Dynamo on CBS Sports Network. Kartik, what do you think about this one?
Yeah, so published reports and my own sourcing can indicate that CBS Sports probably would have gone ahead and done a deal had MLS stayed completely committed to the tournament. So that's a lost opportunity for the tournament and lost revenue for the U.S. Soccer Federation. Now that Apple has gotten themselves into the tournament, it is very possible you will see increased MLS participation, whether it's the full 27 teams or whether it's they have some sort of play-in tournament or they let 16 of their 27 teams participate. I think the key always was Apple and some of the money staying in Soccer United Marketing. So very cynically, you might see MLS's attitude change because and they'll say it's because of the backlash or changes to the format. They'll make some sort of cover story, but it'll be because Apple has gotten their chops into Open Cup.
Yeah, and I think it makes sense in many ways. I mean, if you're a LAFC fan and you're watching the season on MLS Season Pass and then they're playing US Open Cup games and you're like, hey, how come this game isn't on MLS Season Pass? How come I have to go to YouTube or go to ussoccer.com or mlssoccer.com or wherever it may be? It just makes it so difficult. It's an obstacle and it's complicated. So why not put those on MLS Season Pass for people to be able to watch those games on there too? So makes sense to me, but yeah, Kartik, I'm like you.
But, but, But again, MLS is not the only league in this country. For those of us who are focused on USL, or if you watch NISA or you watch something else, those competitions are on different platforms. CBS is a platform that covers more competitions in this country than Apple does. So for me, as someone who's focused on other leagues, CBS made more sense than Apple.
Right. Yep. Same here. Next up is Mike Brennan. He has a question about streaming, and actually Daniel does too. So actually it's more of a comment, but he says, Mike Brennan says, just wondering why Peacock doesn't offer all Premier League matches. Every week there are one or two matches that can only be seen on USA, and these are often the marquee matches of the week. If NBC Universal owns USA Network, why don't we have the option to watch them on Peacock? Similarly, Daniel says, I'm growing more and more frustrated with the lack of accessibility to games. For example, Peacock will raise prices for the 2024-25 Premier League season without a guarantee of getting every Premier League game like I could with La Liga or the Bundesliga on ESPN+. Also, I don't have Paramount+, but when I try to watch the Champions League games that are on over-the-air CBS, and I log into the CBS app on my phone with my basic AT&T TV login, I can't watch the games. The failure of these streaming services to meet the consumers halfway is abysmal. This makes me want to neglect the top leagues in Europe and attach to the lower leagues that I can access on ESPN Plus and other streaming services. What are your thoughts? I love your show and website. Keep up the great work, guys. And Kartik, for you as an employee of a USL club, congratulations, by the way, of getting appointed to hired by the Miami FC. It is one of those things that we've talked about this on the podcast many, for a long time before you got this this job, but how it's so much easier in many ways to watch USL games on ESPN Plus. More so than on an MLS season pass. But both Daniel and Mike's comments are more so about, I mean, the Premier League and top European leagues. As time goes on, I think the expectation is that we would get access to more and more games exclusively, right? Having those games available, all the games available on streaming, just as we've seen with MLS season pass, just as we've seen with ESPN Plus with this USL games, just as we've seen with Bundesliga and La Liga. So are we heading to a place where expectations from viewers should be that we get all games when we sign up for these services?
Yes, and actually USL has become clunkier this year because of the CBS part of the package, their matches. I don't keep up with Golazzo channel, and I get caught off guard every Saturday. Why isn't this match on ESPN Plus? And it turns out Golazzo showing two or three or sometimes even four USL matches a match day. And then CBS Sports Network is showing a ton of USL matches. And those don't get picked up by ESPN streaming. So USL and NWSL have gone in another direction, trying to spread their broadcasts in as many places as possible. Which I don't know. Is this the new model as we figured out streaming and we thought, okay, one-stop shop is going to be most convenient for people, like MLS season pass, like the Bundesliga and La Liga on ESPN Plus. Now we're seeing, at least from two US leagues and obviously the Premier League continuing with their multi-package thing, which by the way, is something that they're accustomed to from the UK market, right? They've always had to have, based on UK competition law, a second network broadcasting matches. So now it's TNT. In the past, it's been various people, but it can't all be on Sky. So here, NBC is a sole rights holder. They've decided to divvy these things up piecemeal. And I think the great frustration is that even though they're showing NBC over-the-air matches on Peacock, they're not showing USA Network matches on Peacock, which reminds us Comcast is a cable company, right? And they want some people to sign up for whatever tier, it's usually the basic tier, that USA is on to keep their cable subscription. So that's sort of sinister. My understanding is that in other sports, it kind of works this way too, because I think now you have broadcast networks and media companies that have learned to game the system. They realize if you make it too simple for consumers and fans, that's less money for them.
Yeah, and with NBC as one example too, just imagine if for this next season, the 2024-25 Premier League season, right? Anticipation is high, everyone's excited, everyone's ready to go. And then right before the season starts, Peacock announces, guess what, guys? Every single game of the Premier League season is going to be on Peacock. No matter if it's on television or not, all the games are going to be on Peacock. What's going to happen to the majority of people who have a cable or satellite subscription, or Fubo for that matter, or Sling TV that get those streaming services to watch the games that are on USA Network or on NBC? Most of those people, the majority of those people will overnight will cancel their cable, will cancel their satellite, will cancel their streaming services and say, hey, this is perfect. Peacock, this is everything I need. And as for as long as NBC is involved and has a TV channel and a cable network, same thing with CBS, as long as they have a TV channel and a cable network, they will make some of those games available exclusively. Well, actually, not exclusively, but on television, and make it harder for people to access those. They would rather everyone try to subscribe to both places, right? Television, cable. And then on the other side, streaming. So it will continue. I don't think it's going to change anytime soon unless we see kind of basically a TV cable as we know it kind of going away completely. And that's not going to happen any overnight. So that's where we're at. Unfortunately, it's the price we pay. And for those leagues that are big enough, so whether it's the Premier League or tournaments, cup competitions such as the Champions League, we're willing to make sacrifices. We as consumers are willing to subscribe to the streaming service and then also subscribe to the cable or TV version of that, so we can access the games that otherwise would not be available on streaming. And then some comments here from listeners about the playoff situation. So this is a podcast we did a couple months ago about talking about how I feel really that playoffs don't work in American soccer because we have competition from around the world. Yes, they work in NBA, they work in baseball, they work in football because you really don't have any competition. But when you have playoffs in a soccer league, it just doesn't make as much sense in the United States, especially when 60%, more than 60% of the teams actually qualify for the playoffs. So why even bother having a regular season? Let's just go straight to the playoffs. Anyway, so some feedback here. Richard says the playoff systems used in American professional sports are made to squeeze more money from fans and media. This system results in the superstars most fans pay to come see taking off days because the playoffs last too long. American owners want guaranteed revenue streams, and many don't care what their records are. One of the previous St. Louis Blues owners said that making the playoffs would cost him money. The rest of the world plays soccer without a playoff system. Americans changed it to soccer with playoffs, but still can't figure out how to play it. Dan Floyd says, your most recent episode had some great discussions about playoffs and promotion relegation. It all boils down to what mechanism is available to keep fans interested. As was discussed, in European soccer, every game matters. A team might win or lose a championship because of their performance against the weakest teams as much as against the best. And then relegation and promotion becomes a life or death struggle. There are reasons to stay interested throughout the entire season. In a closed system, the only way to maintain interest is to hold out hope that lesser teams might find a way to be champions via the playoffs. Baseball was mentioned, and it's a great example. Back in the day, a team might have a bad season and know that they're out of the picture while still having 50 to 60 games to play for the season. Attendance and viewership suffered greatly. Playoffs helped. One other thing is that playoffs and promotion relegation should not mix, keeping in mind that all of the cup competitions are playoffs away from the tables. Mercator says, there are major differences in US and Europe. I do think the European system could work for soccer, and maybe it's preferable. But you have to remember the system other US sports use has a long history of incredible success. We know they work in North America. We know they create the most profitable and, with the exception of soccer, most talented teams and leagues. MLS is no exception here. From an owner's perspective, what they are doing is working very, very well. So I can understand why, if it's not broke, then don't try to fix it. And then two more comments before we get to your feedback, Kartik. John Stevens says, until the soccer pyramid in the US opens up and gives us promotion and relegation, I'll continue to get my soccer fix from France and England. It doesn't matter how many games they play or where they stream them, because the games have no meaning in the US. Dave says, is the Premier League becoming a de facto closed league? If three teams get promoted, have record-breaking bad seasons, and then get relegated, how open is that? I remember the Premier League's relegation battles in the past, where a mid-30-point season was not safe until the last day of the season, a far cry from Luton's 18th place, 26 points this season. So, Kartik, there you go. You got some really good kind of opinions and analysis there from Richard, Dan, Mercator, John, and Dave. Anything you want to talk about from those comments?
Yeah, I'll take the last comment first. That's something I've talked about on TalkSport regularly, that the Premier League is becoming a de facto closed league, and that the Championship is becoming a league with effectively two divisions because of the teams that have parachute payments, because they've been in the Premier League, and teams that don't. Now, sometimes there are clubs that break that glass ceiling, as Ipswich did this year, as Luton did last year. But there are other elements about the Premier League. You've heard me say this on this podcast before, which I liken it more to American sports leagues in the way it's set up and the way it operates than the way La Liga, Bundesliga, and Serie A operated. It's kind of a hybrid model between a fully open league and the closed league system of the U.S. In terms of the playoffs, this is okay. So if we don't have promotion and relegation, do we have to have playoff tournaments to maintain interest? I suppose yes, to a certain extent, but I have to tell you, so we would have to have playoffs in some sense because the schedules are unbalanced, but we could have a 4 or 8 team playoff, as we talked about, not 18 teams, not 16 teams. And here is the thing. I think for the most part, people who watch this sport in this country are going because they love the sport, because there's a certain entertainment aspect, there's a certain community aspect. It's family friendly. None of this stuff revolves around results on the pitch. And I don't think the results are that important. I know when I put this on social media in the past, people have pushed back on me pretty aggressively because they're in kind of a fan bubble where maybe they're very influential in critiquing every MLS match or every USL match or whatever. But I think my experience on the marketing side and sponsorship side is the results don't matter that much. So maybe you could get away with having a 4-team playoff with the best of the best. And if we say the revenue model works for MLS of the playoffs, why do they keep changing the format? The playoff format changes every season. We have started seasons in MLS where we haven't known the playoff format, or at least the public hasn't known the playoff format. There was one season where a technical director in MLS told me they found out the playoff format the Wednesday before the Friday kickoff. The Friday night, there was a Univision game in those days, so Friday night kickoff. This is how always changing it is. Last point. The first comment you mentioned about the St. Louis Blues, yes, playoffs in the United States are based around the idea that they are revenue drivers. That is absolutely the reason we have playoffs. Secondly, that comment about the Blues, I can relate to that comment. I've been with clubs in NASL, NPSL, USL, these lower divisions, where we have openly thought and mused about it would be better not to qualify for the playoffs. It would be better to finish in ninth place or finish just outside so you don't have to pay for travel.
Right.
Because particularly in leagues where you, and this might be why MLS had to change their playoff format, Chris, where everybody's getting home games now. Everybody's guaranteed one home game. If you don't have a home game and you have to pay for travel and you don't have revenue coming in and you're probably going to lose in the first or second round, there really is sometimes no point.
Wow. Yeah. And I think at the end of the day, I think Major League Soccer still needs to decide whether it wants to be a league, a TV league, or an attendance league. Because if you're a TV league, the way you structure the season, the way you structure games and have games played is completely different than an attendance league, where you're trying to get as many home games as possible. You're trying to structure it so that the fans keep faith in the team throughout the season and keep coming back and buying merchandise and all that. And I think what we have is, and what we do have with Major League Soccer, is a league that's successful in attendance, bringing fans to the stadiums, but is unsuccessful on the TV side. And other leagues find more of a balance. Some of them are actually more of a TV league than they are an attendance league, and others find a balance between the two where it both works, where people keep on coming back week in, week out, and also the TV audience is satisfied because they're getting those games that are meaningful, that every game matters and it's exciting. Some games more exciting than others, but they've found a good balance between the two. So that's where I see kind of the playoff discussion, is that if MLS continues and wants to just break attendance records and pack stadiums and build revenue that way, then just focus on keeping the things the way they are now. Otherwise, if they think that they want to be a TV league, we have so much choices, right? On any typical weekend in the regular seasons, we can watch soccer games, practically any live professional soccer team from around the world. There are ways to do it legally to watch those. So on a typical Saturday, there might be over 100 games available to us legally. So why should we choose those 5 or 6 or 10 MLS games or one of those games to watch in the evening? There has to be a compelling reason. Right now, there isn't. The compelling reason last year was Messi. This year is probably Messi to a certain degree, but give us a reason why we should watch, why we should basically kind of set aside our plans, sit down and say, hey, family, we're going to watch a game tonight. And here's why, because this game matters because of A, B, and C, whatever it may be. I still don't think we have that yet. All right, listeners, it's good to be back. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast. We definitely want to hear back from you as far as your questions, your comments, thoughts, whether a positive or negative, or just if you want to argue with us about something, feel free. You can email us at, which is the website, the email address is web@worldsoccertalk.com. You can post your comments on our website at worldsoccertalk.com. Click on the podcast tab and then leave your comments in the most recent episode. On social media, you can tweet us at World Soccer Talk. You can post your comments on youtube.com/worldsoccertalk or send us a message on Facebook at facebook.com/worldsoccertalk. Or you can leave us a voicemail, and that's 561-247-4625. And we'll read out your comments, notes, or suggestions on the next episode. Kartik, what's going on with Beyond the 90? I know you guys are producing a ton of great content, but what should listeners expect, or how can they find your writings and writings of several writers that are covering the beats that they cover?
Yeah, beyondthe90.net or beyondthe90.substack.com. There's a ton of content about lower division soccer, from USL Championship to USL League One to NISA, NPSL, USL Super League, which is actually not a lower division, it's a D1 league. Actually, we've had some coverage also of the Euros and the women's Olympic team selection for the U.S., that selection by Emma Hayes. So lots of stuff going on there. You can check it out at beyondthe90.net.
All right. Enjoy your football.
Whether you know your kimchi from your kefir or it's your first time boiling an egg, you'll be able to make delicious meals easily with The Guardian's new Feast app. Discover vibrant vegan dishes with me, Mira Soda, hearty comfort foods with Nigel Slater, bold flavours with Yotam Ottolenghi, and many more tasty offerings from expert Guardian cooks. Experience the ultimate cooking app, Feast, today. Download now and enjoy a 14-day free trial. Terms and conditions apply.